Not. So just to introduce myself, I don't know why I'm checking, I know. My name is Adrian McLean. I work in the Premier Services business, and I have a small team of consultants and architects who are responsible for developing new service offerings that our PFE organization, the field organization, bring to market. So you may hopefully have heard of the Link RAS, may have seen that in some of the other sessions mentioned. If not, I strongly recommend you go and find out about that. That's a service that my team developed and is now being used worldwide in Premier customers as a kind of new generation health check. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. So what we're going to talk about today is broken down into a number of areas, but the main thing is really making sure that you're making an informed decision about your support service, be that something you're developing internally or something that you're consuming from Microsoft or from a partner or any combination of those three. So our agenda is broken into, as I said, to kind of three key areas. The first piece, we'll just look generically at some of the unique challenges that are involved in supporting a unified communications solution. The middle section of the content, I'm going to take you through the process that we've been using over the past year to help customers arrive at an optimal fit solution for support. And by that, I really mean identifying the requirements that the customer has, the capabilities that they have for support, and then mapping that to a support offering that meets the needs of the overall solution. And then the last piece of the session, I'll talk about the offerings that are available in market today. So those are offerings direct from Microsoft, and those are offerings available from our certified support partners. Just as a quick show of hands, who do we have in the room that's from an end customer? Right, so we can talk about customers. Okay, that's great. And who do we have who's from a partner? Which I'd assume, okay, what's left? What did I miss? Do we, can I? A customer. Okay, so we won't talk. So you'll forgive me if I slip backwards and forwards between talking about how a customer would think about this and then how a partner would think about it. So just press the I believe button, go with me, and hopefully it'll all flow together. So the other question I have is, for those of you in the room, who came to a 100-level business type session this morning just because a 400-level session is going to give you a nosebleed after last night's activities? Because that's okay as well. I get that. I'll be gentle with, right, so we have one at the back. So I will be very gentle with you. I only have probably two slides that are a little bit stretching. So I'll help you through those and make sure you're not feeling too much pain. So first section, supporting unified communications. I think, as I said, before we dive into the guts of the session, I just wanted to talk a little bit about some of the challenges that we've seen customers and partners going through in assessing the needs for support, for merging the teams that support a UC solution, and all those internal challenges and external relationships that change when we move from the world, perhaps of the traditional PBX, to a UC-based solution. So new dynamics, new dependencies, new challenges. It sounds like a great series of statements, but what do we really mean? So I think it's fair to say that we have seen a major transformation in, obviously, the provision of standard PBX infrastructure and a move to software-based applications, voice over IP. This isn't new to anybody, but what is different is the support challenges that that generates. The transformation is not just in the technology as we implement it, but it's also around how the teams that you may have inside a customer organization or with partner organizations now work together in a new and harmonious way, rather than the network guys and the exchange guys or having a fist fight in the car park about whose problem it is that some service has gone down. You know, we definitely see these tensions existing, particularly when traditional PBX replacement projects. And I think really making sure that you're approaching the mapping of a support solution in a way that draws the skills from those teams together to form a new support operation is a critical component to success. I think the other thing is that this really highlights the dependencies of a UC solution, and I'll talk a little bit more about this in a minute. But one of the unique challenges, perhaps, is the UC solution has feet in many different areas. It has authentication, it has network, it has server infrastructure, and all of those dependent components make up the scope of the overall solution support. And so quite often what we're seeing is customers are looking at implementing a solution such as Link, and it just gets lumped with the exchange guys because they're kind of, well, they do kind of server infrastructure-y stuff, and they're the logical team to start with this, and then maybe we'll, you know, sit them next to the network team because we know it has something to do with the network. Gross simplification, I know, but the principle stands. And excuse me. And I think that, again, what we're trying to do is educate customers and partners to really drill into the capabilities that exist inside these organizations, existing support functions, and how they're going to work together effectively to deliver the service that's needed, not just for the Link software stack, but all the dependent components that exist that make Link work. So, there's nobody from consulting services here, is there? No, okay. So I think it's probably fair to say in the past, it's not been entirely uncommon for a customer to have a consulting engagement and then feel a little bereft of the love. Once the design and implementation has been done, the keys get thrown over the wall. I can see Peter's nodding. And they're there left holding the baby, trying to figure out how they're going to operate and support this new environment that they've got. And I think that really, you know, the message to take away is that if you haven't implemented really thorough planning for support and operations during the design activity, then your ability to support that solution is going to degrade over time. Because it might work the day it's installed, but what about the next day and the next day? And as configuration drifts and somebody tweaks something and load on the network changes, unless you've put the right support and operation wrappers in place, the end user experience is going to start to suffer. And all these kind of things, you can see them just slowly spiraling out of control. And then it becomes a very reactive process to try and to claw that back into some good place. So what we're really trying to do, and there's work that is going on with our team at the moment, is to look at how we build these kind of frameworks that tie in with the design phases of a project that really mean that the right activities for design, for support and operations get pulled through into the earlier phases. So how do we go about scoping the kind of support of a solution? We've, during the past 18 months or so, while we've been working with a lot of partners and customers, particularly with the Link Certified Support Partner Program, have gone through this kind of iterative process and developed what we're calling a support solution mapping process. So you'll see traces of ITIL and MOF in here. What we believe is this kind of fits in under those frameworks and gives a technology-centric view on what it needs, what you need to do for just Link specifically and then all its dependencies, rather than at a more generic level, yes, you know you need to have good process, you need to have the right people, you know you need to have escalations, but how does this really work for Link? And so this is a process we've gone through with a number of customers to help them derive an RFP, say, for a support offering that they're looking to source from a partner. So what follows as we click through, as you can see, my PowerPoint skills are almost legendary. We have we have an initial phase which is capturing support requirements, and I'll drill into each of these in just a little bit more detail to set some context about what I mean by that, because quite often these get confused with architectural requirements, sort of functional requirements of a solution. And there is clear water between what we think about in the support space and what we think about from an architect's perspective. The next phase of this process would be to then look at the components of the Link solution itself. So we've talked to the business, we've understand what the requirements are of the support solution. Now let's actually look at either an as-deployed environment or what is proposed to be deployed. So this is probably an architecture design document if the environment isn't already built. The next step is to look at what existing support functions exist within the customer or perhaps a partner that they use today to deliver support services, and what SLAs are in place. Because clearly, if you have incumbent partners who are delivering certain services that overlap with the Link solution, then you're going to look to leverage those. But it's whether or not those existing contracts and arrangements actually meet the need of the new solution that's being put in place. Then we start to pull these three together, and say, okay, we understand what the requirements of the solution are. We know what the components are that are to be deployed, so servers and pools and all of that infrastructure stuff. And we know what the capability is. Let's actually map those together. And we've built a process of support mapping that enables us to correlate the requirements of the solution from a business and a technical perspective to an organization's ability to support each of those individual components. Now, in theory, once you've been through that process, if you have lines in this, I have imaginary spreadsheet in front of me, but if you have lines in this spreadsheet which identify an infrastructure component and nothing next to it to say, well, this gets supported by this team and then they escalate to these guys, if that line's blank, we've just identified a gap in your overall solution approach. Those empty lines are what we look to say, right, that's the remediation plan or that's the RFP that you would use to go and build that capability in-house, talk to a partner to find that capability that they can deliver to you. And so, hey presto, we have effectively scoped, by doing that gap analysis, we've scoped the overall requirements of the solution. And as I said, this is at least two or three customers in the past few months we've worked with who our engagement has been really to help them generate an RFP. And that outcome is how they then go to their incumbent partners or partners out in the market to purchase a support offering that's the right fit for them and is tailored specifically to their support requirements. And there's clearly a build in there which doesn't do anything. There we go. So, what are support requirements? Now, I'm going to give you pre-warning. In a couple of slides' time, we've got one of these slightly challenging things, so bear with me, and I'll try and ease you through, particularly for those of you who are feeling delicate this morning. So this is a difficult concept, I think, for a lot of consultants. We see it in our own field. It took us a while, I think, to get our heads around this. But what do we define as a support requirement? And really, it's about non-functional requirements. Now, bear with me on that. I'm going to quote to you from Wikipedia. Non-functional requirements are requirements that specify criteria that can be used to judge the operation of a system rather than its specific functions. The plan for implementing non-functional requirements is detailed in a system's architecture. The plan for implementing functional requirements is detailed in the system design. Is that totally 100% clear? Right, so let me see if I can turn that into something which is a little more digestible. Let's think about this from a Link perspective. A functional requirement for a Link implementation would be that you can route a call to a given group of users. That's something the solution has to be able to deliver, otherwise the solution isn't fit for purpose. A non-functional requirement in that same context would be that you have that ability, but it's available for, let's say, 5 days a week, and that it can only suffer a two-hour outage in any given 16-hour window. I'm making the numbers up, but as an example, that really starts to differentiate the difference between a functional requirement, which is something the solution has to deliver and is part of how you would design a system, but then the non-functional is more about how it's run. So these are sometimes called the illities, which works well for usability, reliability, not so much for performance, and then supportability. And I've got some examples for each of these, hopefully, that make some sense here. I've got key business requirements in here as well, just because they tend not to be, a business tends not to articulate non-functional requirements terribly well, in my experience. But understanding why a customer has deployed Link, what they're trying to derive from the solution, what value they're trying to get, is extremely valuable context for all the other non-functional requirements. So it's one just to have in mind when you sit down and run a workshop to sit with a customer and understand what are, and I've switched to partner mode now, but if you're sitting with a customer and having that discussion, it's really just understanding that context and then how they want the solution or how the solution needs to be run in order to meet those business needs. So usability. How easy is it for a user to use the system? Do they have the necessary training? Is there a button they can click to go for online support? These are functions of how the user interacts with the system. So it's not a technical, oh, we need three servers with these colored lights to make a call happen. It's much more about the end user experience and how you can spend all your money you like on that architecture and making your lights blue, and that's fantastic. But if the user doesn't know how to make a call or join a conference, then all that investment was rather wasted. reliability. So this is where you get into terms like mean time before failure. What's an acceptable time to repair? So in that example I used earlier, you start to think about what are the availability requirements of the system to deliver the service, which are the functional requirements. Do you have a maximum allowable downtime? So why is this important? Well, if you start to think about how your help desks are structured or how the contracts that you put in place to... Somebody at the door. how your contracts are structured, where you're backing off support to, say, to a vendor for a particular component, your ability to recover from failure is intimately linked to that set of structures and contracts and relationships. So that's why this is important in this context. Performance. So how should the system behave under load? And I think more significantly, how are you going to measure that? And this isn't, again, you know, the architect comes in, yep, that'll support 5,000 users. Thanks very much. Give me a big bag of money. Off I go. Now you've got 6,000 users, or usage patterns for those 5,000 users are changing. You're seeing greater adoption. More people are using conferences. Conferences are getting bigger. These are all non-functional requirements that the system needs to be able to deliver against. Can a user join a conference? That's a functional requirement. Can the system track usage over time and you be able to adapt the environment to support changing load? Those are non-functional requirements that you would build into your into your monitoring solution. So again, these fall again in this right-hand side as, again, I've got a project timeline in front of me here. Design and architecture, envisioning all that stuff's here. Support and operations is over this side. And I think that, again, all of these sorts of things fall into that right-hand side. Supportability. I don't mean asking someone to come in and look at a design and say, can we support this? It's much more about how is the environment going to be maintained? And who's going to do it? How are you going to carve up the tasks that are necessary in order to run and optimize a Link solution over time? Who's going to look at, who's going to define and monitor the key health indicators that you may have defined for the environment? Who's going to look at trending? How are you going to do that capacity planning long term? So those all fall into that supportability bucket. So typically we see this activity as a workshop with a customer, and the critical piece of making that successful is this. You need to make sure you have the right people in the room when you're having that discussion to drive out the requirements. Pardon me. And it really does span the entire organizational structure. To be honest with you, my personal view, let's have a vote. Who thinks the executive is the most important? No, not getting any hands. Core team? Good, we're all on the same page here. User community? these are the people that scream the loudest when there's a problem. They're the ones that are experienced the service of the system. So making sure you have representative or individuals that represent the user community as part of the discussion about how the system is expected to behave, and that really ties into that usability area that we talked about a second ago, what their end user experience is, how they get support, how quickly support responds to them. If you've got an IM-based system that provides support, if IM's down, what do they do next? I mean, all of those sorts of things that you need to think about. So the success of this initial phase is really all about making sure you've got the right people in the room. Other areas to look at are historical, typically. So many of the things that you'll be introducing into an environment may exist in some form already. There may be some existing IAM and presence solution. There'll certainly be telephony in the environment, and there may be conferencing. But what are the challenges that you experience today? Are you experiencing long resolution times to particular problems? If you are, where are those issues being derived from? Is that something? Is that an internal issue, troubleshooting and escalation issue, or is it something to do with a vendor that's involved in the overall support of the solution? Who maintains accountability for an issue when it's been opened? This becomes absolutely critical in the world of implementing UC. Because, as I said, we have all these dependencies and the different components in the environment. Who ultimately is the team or the focal point, the one throat to choke, that is responsible for ensuring issues get resolved, even when it means you're having to draw resources from multiple teams to solve a problem? That's something that's absolutely critical and really ties back again to that user's experience of how an escalation takes place and how quickly they see a resolution. So the background history, looking at previous case analysis, if you have any of that historical analysis available in the customer's environment, is a really useful insight into how support and operations work today. And again, it's one of these that forms that kind of useful context, a bit like the key business requirements, as you're starting to derive these support requirements for the environment. So, key takeaway, do the due diligence. We just can't emphasize this enough. Where this has been done well, we don't hear about the problems in the customer environment. The support offering is a good fit for the customer's needs, and we're confident that the process that's gone through to arrive at that fit between customer requirement and support solution has been rigorous and touched on all the points that we've talked about. So the next step in that diagram I had was then looking at the environment itself. So we've talked to the business owners, the people that use the solution and understand requirements from their perspective. The next piece is really understanding what has been deployed or what is about to be deployed. This is the first of those, or probably the second now, these really nasty slides. And the color choice, the kind of strange puce green, is particularly inappropriate for a sore head this morning, so I apologize for that. The point of what we're trying to get across here is, if you look at the stuff in green, if you can bear to for a moment, is that is the Lynx software component of this notional UC environment. It's not all of it by any stretch of the imagination. And I think what we're really trying to encourage people to do as they look at the environment is, great, you've got your design document maybe, or you've dragged the environment out of Topology Builder and you've looked at what's been deployed for Link. It doesn't tell anywhere near the whole story about the components in the environment that make that solution work. So typically in a design document, there'll be some stuff, we need some DNS records and we'll need this in AD and we'll need a service connection port, blah, 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 blah. What it doesn't really then exactly. All of that, you know this well. But what it doesn't then do is then drill into the, yes, okay, so that is a dependency. Let's say DNS is a dependency, but how is DNS operated? How is it maintained? And how does that relate to the design goals that we stated in the architecture document in the first place? So it's important that we look beyond just the Lynx software stack itself. And I think that, again, that we recognize that linked solutions involve multiple technologies and multiple vendors in order to reach that overall solution state. So, as I think I said probably for the third time now, evaluating the dependencies. If you take nothing away from this session, evaluating the dependencies is probably the key message. But consider the relationships between the infrastructure components and support. And what we're going to do is build a little diagram out here that will show you how we think about that. So our first component is a pool in this example. And what we're trying to do is look at, okay, so a pool has a series of dependencies. Let's have a dependency. Well, in this case, we've said it's DNS. Now, obviously, there's going to be a series of other dependencies, and some of the work we've been doing is to sit with customers and build a standard template and simply say, right, for a pool, here are all the dependencies. And if you're familiar with ITIL and MOF, service mapping is a process that goes some way towards this, and this actually what we have here is an adaptation of the service mapping methodology. But we define a standard list of dependencies. From there, we start to build out a support path. So, who's responsible for DNS? If there's an issue with DNS, who do you call? Who's that responsible for that first tier of support? And then beyond that, who do you go to next? How does the escalation path build? So keep that concept in your head. We'll come back to this slide in a few minutes, and we'll look a little bit about how we extend it out then to look beyond just the simple escalation. But I think the critical part, is that as you look at your link environment, the dependencies for many of the infrastructure components within link are common. So DNS is a common dependency, network is a common dependency. But you can then start to, and in the next phase what we'll start to do is say that's great from a technology perspective, but what we now need to do is overlay some of those non-functional requirements. So the example that we tend to use is perhaps you have a team based in Japan who needs support in local language. Well, that's a non-functional requirement that also should build into your support solution, because that's driving a dependency on your support teams and therefore is something that you need to consider as part of the overall support solution. So, key takeaway from understanding the environment is look beyond the server infrastructure itself and look at the dependencies of the technology that are in the environment that enable that link solution to function. Okay, so the next phase is to identify within the customer's environment what the support functions are. So if you remember, we're going through this, we're saying, what's the business requirement? What's been deployed or will be deployed in the environment and what are its dependencies? And now let's look at what exists in terms of capability, be that from a customer's own capability or from a partner perspective, to meet the needs of the environment that we've identified. This again typically is a workshop type activity that we do, sitting down with a partner, and with any luck their vendors in the room, if you can achieve that. That's a sitting down with the customer, sorry, and their partners in the room. And really starting to drill down to how the environment that they have today is supported, what skill sets are available. So you may need to go through a process of interviews and assessing capabilities in different support teams. I know quite often this is where we get back into that point I made earlier about you see friction between teams. Sometimes when you're deploying a UC solution. So the last thing you need is an idiot like me turning up with a clipboard saying, right, what do you do? And how do you, that approach, immediately people back off and say, oh, hang on a minute, this, you know, my job's at risk. We're not going to talk to you guys. So think about how you engage in this process. But the key piece is making sure that you understand what the capabilities are of the teams, and you need to be realistic about that. Sending people just on, you know, if you're talking about supporting a large enterprise environment, sending them on a couple of training courses probably isn't going to be the skill set they need. They're going to need to be, you know, you're going to be looking to make sure that they've had experience of building out the solution. They've been part of the design process, that all that knowledge transfer is starting to happen. So make sure you take that into account when you're looking at the skill sets of teams. Again, I think often a lot of networks folks will turn around and say, well, it's just linked voice stuff. We do that day in, day out. You don't need to worry about that. It'll all be fine. Maybe. I think the key point is that they may be able to say that because they understand the environment as it stands today, and they can work with the telecoms folks to troubleshoot call quality issues or bandwidth planning or whatever it is in a very deep way today. Do they know how to dig into a QoE database to pull out some statistics to figure out? Right, exactly. It's just not something that, it's not a skill set that they have. And so again, being very honest and clear about what those requirements are and the capabilities that exist in the environment is a critical path to getting this right. The vendor and support contract piece is another one as well. Again, this can be sensitive information in customer environments. They may not want to share all of that detail. And certainly if you start talking to the partners can be understandably not necessarily hugely willing to share the details of a contractual arrangement they have with the end customer. You need the business sponsors to help you get that information. It's important because it helps you build the understanding of those escalation paths, which is something we'll look at in a second. SLAs tie into all of that. But again, we're looking back again at maybe some historical data, typical resolution times. It's one thing for a contract to have an SLA in it. It's another thing entirely for the vendor, the partner, whoever it is, to be delivering against the SLA. It's another thing again for the customer to actually be implementing an expectation that the partner will meet that SLA. So actually tracking and saying, well, you didn't meet the SLA, unless there's a financial penalty involved. My experience is quite often, yes, we have an SLA with these guys. Well, how often are we actually checking to see if they're meeting it? So again, these are subtleties, but they are absolutely critical to making sure that you've really got a good grip on how the support and the escalation process will work in particular. And the last point around interoperability with other systems, again, this points back to the understanding the scope and the nature of the customer's environment. Do they have contact centers? Is that an area that you're going to need to be able to escalate support into? Even if Link isn't directly integrated with the contact center, you may have Link cloud of stuff contact center. Now, cloud of stuff could be any number of things, but the reality is if a Link user can't work in some way, put a call through to the contact center, it's Link's fault. That's how it's going to manifest. The call's going to come into the help desk. Link is broken. I can't call the guys in the contact center. So again, it's understanding, okay, well, how are you going to troubleshoot that? What's the path through cloud of stuff out to the contact center folks and making sure that you've got that traceability through the environment. And this really ties, I've probably jumped ahead a little bit, this really ties, as I said, into the escalation experience that the customer has today. So who maintains overall ownership of UC support issues? Hands up who hasn't seen wild finger pointing when it comes down to trying to deal with support issues in any environment that has more than one component in it. It's just a fact of life, right? I mean, it's one of those things where no matter how well you define the boundaries, the handoff points, inevitably the network folks will say, come on, it's never the network. The network's fine. The security folks are saying, firewall ports are all open. There's no issues. I don't know what you're talking about. And still the user can't make a call. You know, you get into that. And I think really making sure that you have good ownership, it's well understood between all the different teams about who is responsible for the support of UC, maintains that ownership. But also that those individual teams recognize that that is a central function which is going to maintain ownership. And usually you need a business sponsor to drive that kind of behavior into support organizations. I think we've talked probably pretty well about most of the points on here, but going back again to end user satisfaction. So I think it's a horrible generalization, but probably true, but the the admin team that might work with the board of directors are usually the ones that are shouting the loudest on behalf of the directors because a director can't make a call to A or B. You know, that is a really common scenario. So understanding the level of satisfaction they have with support today and then setting an expectation with, as you go into the planning process for support, that you need to deliver at least that and better to ensure that the solution is seen as a success is a critical part of the process. And I think really having that, we go back to this user communities thing, making sure you've got the right representation from all these groups across the organization is a key component. So I would hope that most of the folks in this room are familiar with the concept of a support team structure. It is remarkable, I think, the number of customers that we engage with who kind of squint at this slide and really come to really struggle as to how they map their organization to the sorts of roles and responsibilities we see here. I mean, this is a generic example, right? But I don't think anybody would disagree that in an ideal world, this is the kind of structure that you would see in a support operation. For most customers, it doesn't exist exactly like this. We get that. Every environment is managed and run slightly differently. But being able to associate the functions that exist at each of these tiers with any one team, that's really hard. That's really, really hard. The roles and responsibilities often are not clear and distinct. And part of this work that we believe we ought to be doing with customers or as customers really should be looking at, again, as we're looking at the support solution overall, at the detail of what are those, you know, at what point does a team escalate? What is the expectation of tier one? Is there a frontline support? What's given to them in all, you know, what scripts are given to them to try and help troubleshoot issues before they have to escalate? All of that. So I think really this is a useful example just to help customers or look at support organizations and try to start to align the functions that you see with the kind of more generic expectations that we might have in a help desk. Oh, service level agreements. Joy. Probably the most abused term and misused term in the IT industry to date. So again, this varies a lot between customers. And, you know, we hear things, oh, time to respond, a time to escalate, a maximum downtime. I mean, depending on how contracts are written or help desks and support functions are established, these terms are used interchangeably, variably. And so, again, I think the point really is understanding how existing functions handle escalations, the time for response, how quickly they're likely to escalate to the next tier if they can't resolve something. and really, you know, again, what are the staffing levels at the various tiers? What's the, you know, if you've got a service that's available 24/7, do you really have people on call at tier three and tier four? You know, really just getting a deep understanding of how SLAs have been implemented, if they have been implemented, and how maybe they have operating level agreements, the OLAs, between the different teams. We have dependencies on different services, whether or not those are in place. Because again, this all comes back to how's that escalation path going to work? So, key takeaway, critically examine. And I mean with a critical mindset. Don't take the first answer and, yeah, that's fine, the network guys do that, it's no problem. Really dig deep into the detail and flush out the detail and make sure that you have a really clear and crisp understanding of what the existing capability looks like. And that way, you're in the perfect position to go to the next step, having talked to the business, we know their requirements, we know what's been deployed, we now know their capability, and so we now go into mapping those together to understand where the gaps are. So, here we have our friendly slide again. See, I told you my PowerPoint skills were legendary, and if you missed that build, I can do it again if you need to see it. So this is a process that we've termed support structure mapping. It is effectively a derivation from service mapping. And what it does is it takes, as I said earlier, the list of components that exist within a technical components that list with, that exist within a linked solution, their dependencies, and then the escalation paths up through the organization to ultimately who is tier four. Who is it the vendor? Does the buck stop with the partner? What is that ultimate point of escalation? And the other thing that we overlay on this is we take those other non-functional requirements that we got. So this is great if the support desk is working in English, but if the team in Japan need local language support, you need to build another one of these paths in the big spreadsheet that you start to build out, which shows you that there's another requirement on that particular pool. And again, that means there's a requirement on the support function and then the messaging team and the network and so on. So it's really trying to merge the technical as-is or to-be environment and overlaying it with the non-functional requirements, which are just as critical to the success of the support solution. And hopefully, you won't do this. You won't find gaps, but I suspect you probably will, because infrequently do people go through the full process of really drilling into this in considerable detail. But the idea behind this whole process is to find those gaps and identify where the support escalation process breaks down. That is where you're starting to create your list of requirements for the support solution, which is over here in my mental picture. Does that, I just want to pause for a second. Does that make sense conceptually? I don't think anything we're talking about is rocket science. It's just good practice. What is very challenging is pulling it all together into effectively a support project, which runs absolutely conjoined with the architecture and design. But I think, I hope, as you can see, if you go through this process, by the end of it, you've got a really crisp definition of the gaps in the environment, and you're spending all this time and effort and money over here doing the design and architecture, which is great. And in isolation, that will give you 100% availability. Unfortunately, and start using it and start supporting it, then everything changes, all bets are off. And obviously, you're into day-to-day operations, as you are with any IT or technology infrastructure. So again, this process is not unique to Link. But we think it is, in order to be successful with those deployments and end users and customers to get the best experience, it's something which quite often just simply doesn't get done to the level of detail that it deserves. Pause there for a second. So the gap analysis will identify, hopefully, gaps in our support strategy. And really help you focus in on which aspects of the Link solution are at risk. Now, maybe that's fine. Maybe you find components that aren't as critical, and if you don't have a good escalation path, well, maybe that's something that's acceptable to the business. And so really, again, this iterative process of identifying the gaps, working with the customer, understand which of those they see as critical, because now you can tie those back to components of the environment that may fail to meet an SLA. That's really, it's really enabling you to have a different conversation rather than that's broken, you just don't have enough support for that. You can very clearly show the correlation between because you don't have the right support for that, whatever it is, these are all the dependencies back into the environment, the technology components, the non-functional requirements that you've identified, which are at risk, and you may not be able to meet the SLA for the service because of this broken path. The other thing it's very useful for is identifying teams that may be over or underutilized in terms of the scope of the support solution. So one of the things that we noticed in a couple of customers where we ran this activity was that one team just did everything, or the support was scattered across so many different teams that it was becoming unmanageable. And actually, that pointed to a different set of problems that really and goes all the way back to the beginning. I'm getting nods of agreement. All the way back to the beginning, what we talked about is that friction, the existing support structure, how they don't talk to each other. If you see yourself going off in this kind of fan effect of loads of different teams being involved, you're immediately increasing the risk any one of those paths fails and the whole thing falls apart. And I think, again, it's a really useful activity so customers can get that view and say, you know, maybe this is an opportunity to merge those two functions. Let's tidy up the structure in order to provide a better level of service. So, key takeaway. Understand what aspects of your linked service solution have incomplete support and escalation paths. And I think really that whole middle part of this session is really about making sure that you've done that due diligence, that you understand what the business needs, how the solution is being deployed, the existing capability, and how all that comes together, and whether or not you have these gaps that put the overall solution at risk. So now you've done that, with a bit of luck, you've got a nice table, probably a PowerPoint, maybe an RFP, you're now talking to procurement about, right, this is what we need a partner to come in and deliver all of these services, this stuff we're going to do in-house, we're going to get Microsoft to come in and do a lot of readiness for this team so they can build some capability, we're going to go and get a training partner, whatever it is, but you can start to address those gaps. And this second section of the deck talks about the support offerings that are available in market today from Microsoft, and then we'll talk about how our partners, some of whom are in the room here today, can offer that end-to-end solution support that we believe is so critical. So, over the past 2 years, we've worked with a lot of customers and a lot of partners. Support for Link has evolved. I think it's fair to say. We've seen a lot of change. We're seeing a lot more adoption. And that's really kind of driving a lot of focused thinking around how do we make sure customers get the right support offering. And the primary feedback we got when engaging with partners and customers and working with them to figure out how a partner can help, how Microsoft can help, perhaps under a Premier contract, the primary feedback we got is that choice is the most critical component. The thing that we, Microsoft, can do to enable our customers to be successful is to enable choice in the market. So that if you're at particular phases of the life cycle of a project, you can get just the right support that's available for you at that point in time. And that can evolve over time to include different components, partner offerings, or if you're looking to maybe a managed service solution or something like that, that you can engage, you can identify and engage the right partner to enable you to run that service or for them to run that service on your behalf. And obviously this stretches across both on-premise, private cloud, hosted cloud. So we're really looking to understand, you know, all of those different ways in which Link can be deployed and the different services. I'm not going to talk about Link Online today, just to be clear. That's we can have an offline conversation about that. There are offerings that Premier has in that space, but this discussion is primarily focused on Link on premise or private hosted cloud. But again, it's really making sure that we have choice across those range of potential solutions that are being deployed. So, talk about three options. You can tell I stole these slides from marketing because it's all big boxes and we're getting lower on the level of detail. So, I think if I were to summarize, there are three kind of broad offerings available in market today. The first one is Microsoft Premier Support. So from Premier today, if you have a Premier contract, you can open a case and I have a problem with Link and we will go through our normal triage and troubleshooting and escalation processes in order to help you resolve that issue. Standard response times for Premier apply, depending on whatever the nature of your contract. But that's definitely a standard kind of support offering. No frills. I mean, if you have a crit sit, sure, you know, all the alarm bells go off and things get escalated to tier three very quickly. But the reality is you'll come in at standard tier one and your case will be escalated through the Premier support infrastructure, as with any other technology. The critical piece is scope. We do product support. Microsoft does support of our products. We do not support the gateway, the PBX, the whatever it is, you know, the other infrastructure components, unless it's got Microsoft software, so it's DNS and it's a Windows server, you know. So we do not provide support in that space. And so it's incumbent on the customer to have joined the dots and said, oh, well, I need the support contract for that piece as well. And then, but that makes me responsible for figuring out whose problem it is so I can call the right people and, you know. And in fairness, you know, the Microsoft support teams will always do their best to help you eradicate an issue from an environment and identify root cause. But we simply aren't in a position to troubleshoot an audio codes gateway or a SNOM phone or what, you know, whatever it is. They are third-party products made by vendors and partners, and it is down to the customer to put the right support in place for those other components. Elevated support. Number two, Premier support for Link. This is another direct-to-customer offering, and it's a tier three offering. Now, what we mean by that is you pay extra, it costs more. You know, standard Premier contract, you get hours within the contract and you call those off across the different products. Here you're buying tier three just for Link. And tier three means that you will come straight in to our escalation engineer tier. So these are the guys and girls who get the calls that have been escalated up when things have gone horribly wrong and tier one, tier two can't figure it out. So the point about using a more expensive premium service like that is you need to be sure you have the tier one and tier two capability yourself as a customer in order to derive value from that tier three service. So if we're talking about an enormous company who has really capable internal support teams, help desks, they've gone through this fantastic support mapping activity that I've heard about recently, they've figured out all their gaps, and they've plugged those internally, and they have all the right support contracts in place for all the additional components in the infrastructure, that's a great offering for them. Because they get from Microsoft just the escalation level, the really deep technical support very quickly from our escalation teams at Tier 3. But you do pay a premium for that, obviously. And then the third option is support from one of our certified support partners. Now, as you can see here, the critical piece, the difference, is scope. And we'll drill into this in a little bit more. I think I've just spoken to most of my next three slides. But the partner-based offerings are the only ones that can deliver solution support. And by solution, I mean all the stuff from the device that you pick up on the desk to the gateway to the network. That diagram with a really nasty green color, it's all the stuff in gray, all those other components around it. So let's look quickly at each one of these in turn. How are we doing for time? My clock isn't working. We're approaching time. Okay, so we'll go through these quickly. So Microsoft Premier, I think minimal support needs. I wouldn't necessarily, the minimal implies somehow that, you know, the support isn't needed, it isn't very good. The point really is that it's a standard level of support for the software component itself. And as we've said, support comes in at tier one. So your case will come into the tier one help desk along with all the other cases for Exchange and SharePoint and Dynamics and blah and whatever. And you'll go through the process of working with tier one and tier two to get the issue resolved. Premier support for Link, this is the tier three offering I was just talking about. And again, it's an add-on to an existing Premier contract. You can't buy this in isolation. You have to have a Premier contract in place already, and then you add this on as an additional offering. But as I said, it has, really the expectation is that the customer has good quality tier one, tier two capabilities themselves, good link skills in-house. The other differentiator here is it does include some proactive services as part of the deal, as part of the bundle price that you pay for this service. One of those is the Link RAS, which I mentioned earlier, and I would encourage you all to look at the sessions delivered by my colleague here, Keith, earlier in the week. But that is a subscription-based service. You get that for a year, and it effectively gives you an ongoing health check of your environment. Cloud-based service, a lot easier than getting an engineer to come to site every 6 months, run a bunch of tools, assess your environment. I'll talk a little bit more about RAS in a second. But those are included as part of the package. And actually, a support mapping type activity is also included as part of this, because what we're trying to do is help customers derive the best value from a more expensive tier three offering so we can identify those gaps and make sure they do have the capability at tier one and tier two. Uh-oh. Oh, there we go. And then the last one, solution support. So as I said, the scope of what Microsoft can offer to customers is limited to product support. Only the partners who've gone through our certified accreditation program to become a Link Certified Support Partner, otherwise known as PSLP, that's another acronym that the program goes under, are in a position to deliver this end-to-end solution support that is directly backed by Microsoft. So these partners have a tier three contract with us, and they are effectively fulfilling that tier one, tier two capability for the customer, but also the wealth of all the other components of the Link solution that make up the overall environment. The other critical piece is that partners can tailor this to the specific needs of an individual customer. It is more difficult for Microsoft to do that. And I think, really, that partners are in a unique position to be able to deliver against that whole process that we talked about of identifying the requirements, looking at the gaps, and then defining an RFP that a partner can come in to talk to you about delivering a service against because you've done that detailed gap analysis. They can also bring a whole bunch of other services to bear that Microsoft doesn't have the capability to do. So I think, again, really worthwhile looking at this as an option for Link environments. We have over 100 certified partners worldwide today. So we really have reached critical mass with this program. And they offer a huge variety of additional complementary offerings from fantastic monitoring and reporting, from high availability devices that magically fail over, and all sorts of good stuff. Again, things beyond the scope of what Microsoft can provide. So I definitely recommend, if you need to find that site, it's at this really easily digestible link here if you want to write that one down. Alternatively, just go to Bing and plug in Link Certified Support Partners. And that will take you to the site where we have all the partners who are listed on TechNet who are certified worldwide, the regions in which they operate, and contact details on how to get to them. Right. Just before we close, I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the proactive services that Microsoft has available in this space, because that's another area of responsibility that we have, which ties into some of the things that we've been talking about today. I know we've kind of done this one to death, but bear with me for a minute. Just show of hands, who is familiar with Link RAS or Wrap as a Service? Okay, great. So who's heard of a health check or a wrap? Okay, so a few. Okay, so Microsoft Premier has, over the years, had a number of services which are effectively health checks or risk assessment programs. That involved an engineer coming to site, running a bunch of tools, and providing a report and a remediation plan saying, here are the 15 things that are broken in your environment. This is how to address them. This is the risk associated with each of those. And if you want us to come and help, we can do that, and so on. Wrap as a Service is a cloud-based offering, which we launched in October last year. Yes, thank you. For RAS, for Link, which enables you to download a tool, gather the information from your Link environment, compress it, upload it into our secure cloud, and we then run over 1,000 rules across 300 data points that we capture to generate a report, which is effectively the same as having an engineer sitting on site. The difference is you can run this as many times as you like for the period of a year if it's a subscription-based service. The first engagement, you will have an engineer review the report for you and provide you with recommendations on how to remediate the issues that have been found. But it's a great way of being able to track behaviors in your environment, watch for configuration change, but critically ensure that you're regularly checking the overall health of the Link environment. Yes, sir. It is available for direct sale to end customers or through partners who have a Premier contract. So, it is available as a sell-through. That's an option which has just come on stream recently. And we have a lot of partners who are really interested in doing exactly that. Great. Because I think they really see the opportunity, if I'm speaking very honestly, as this will derive a long list perhaps of problems that have been found. Well, that's a services engagement right there to sit down with a customer and say, "Right, let us help you resolve all these issues that we found in the environment." I think customers like it, even when it's sold through a partner, because they see the IP coming from Microsoft. So the big brains of people like these guys, where we've derived all these rules from MCS and from CTS, et cetera, and so forth, this rule, and from TechNet product group, I mean, the list is endless. But you get that, and it's a Microsoft report that says, "This is the health of your environment as it stands today." The other very exciting announcement, I'm British, so this is excited as I get, so just go with me. But the exciting announcement at Link's conference, you're hearing it probably third or fourth here, but is the call quality methodology. So the sessions that are running this actually parallel with this one and later today, You Sound Marvelous, which is a whole new way of thinking about assessing and analyzing call quality. Fantastic stuff that the product group have done. Jens Trier Rasmussen and Andrew Snyderman have done that work. We've taken those principles and concepts and built them into RAS. So if you subscribe to the RAS service today, not only will you get a 100-page report on the health of your environment with risk assessments, et cetera, and so forth, you'll also get a secondary report which does a call quality analysis and starts you down the road towards analyzing health of voice specifically in your environment. So, CQM, call quality methodology, look out those sessions. It's really, really cool stuff. I wish I had time to take you through it here, but definitely I've got those on the slides for you to get the details of later. And then I think finally, as we wrap this up, just a commitment from us to you to say we are looking at expanding the portfolio of services and offerings that we have from Microsoft today in the Link space. It's specifically what my team is chartered to do. I think, in the Premier Services catalog today, we don't have a large number of service offerings around Link, and we're working very, very hard to address that through 2014. So, and again, these will be available as proactive services that can be consumed direct to customer, if that's how the relationship works, or through partner. So partners can have a Microsoft engineer deliver a service on their behalf, and it helps partners augment their portfolio of service offerings that they can offer an end customer. So, stay in touch with your TAMs as we start to announce the new service offerings. They'll be kept up to date. So, key takeaway from choosing a support offering. I think we've talked a little about the offerings that Microsoft has available direct to customer, and then the offerings that we have that we back from our partner community, the certified partner community, who are really well placed to give that end-to-end solution support. And hopefully, this kind of ties together the whole of the deck as we just look at what is it that we're trying to achieve here? We're trying to achieve best fit for a support offering against a solution design or implementation. So we know there are unique challenges in supporting unified communications. We talked about that. And the process of scoping a support solution has its own challenges associated with it. But if you take a structured approach, you do it at the time when the design is being done, ideally. So you do it early in the project life cycle, understand the requirements, understand the environment that's going to be deployed or has already been deployed, look at the capabilities the customer has in their environment today to support what's coming, and then do that mapping to identify the gaps. And that is then your basis to either remediate, ready, contract additional services to meet the overall requirements of the solution from a support perspective. So, as I said, recommended sessions. So, Best 202, which is, there's two deliveries of that one. And so there's a follow-up this afternoon, yes, at 2:45. That one looks, RAS features in there, albeit briefly. So we look at, so Keith from my team, we're looking at the variety of tools. I'm sure if you started to investigate the link space, you're familiar. There's a whole bunch of tools available, System Center Advisor. I've just told you about RAS. And that's really about understanding where they fit, when you would use each one. But you can get some more information on RAS in that session. Network 304 and 400, these are the two core quality methodology sessions. If you can't get to see them, watch the recordings. This is groundbreaking stuff that Andrew and Jens have come up with. We saw it and said, we have to get this to customers. This is absolutely critical in order to help them get to root cause as quickly as possible and think about voice quality in a different way. And that's why we made the investment and built it into RAS. So there's some great sessions to see there. The first one is more a kind of high-level introduction to the concepts, and then maybe if you're fragile today, the 400-level one from Jens, maybe a bit much. It's deep SQL queries and all sorts of good stuff, but it really gives some insight on how that process works. And last but not least, myself and the team, we're staffing the kiosk, the services kiosk in the pavilion. So if you have any questions, please give us a shout. And at the back of the room, there's a little pile of cards for you to take away. We're advertising a session that the MSIT Academy is starting up this year. It's run in Redmond, and it's about coming to see how Microsoft does Link. I think it's going to be an awesome thing to be able to participate in. So do grab a flyer. We're dotting them around the place. Grab a bunch, give them to your friends, take them home for the kids to scroll on, whatever works. That's it from me. Any questions? Any follow-up questions? Desperate to get away for a coffee. Peter? I knew you'd ask me something. That's a great question. So just to make sure for the recording we heard that, is there anything different about what we talked about here today? Effectively, if this product was Exchange that we were talking about or it was SharePoint, really would we recommend a different approach? Why would Link be different? Why would we go to all this additional effort? I'll give you a good consulting answer, yes and no. No, Link isn't different from the perspective of any good project engagement should do this stuff anyway. This is just good practice. I think, what we're trying to do, though, is bridge a gap between the design and deployment, or the design and deployment phase and the support and operations phases, which just tends to naturally exist for reasons unknown. But yes, Link is different, and I think it's because of the third-party components that make up the solution. So we have a broader range of dependencies on other components which aren't necessarily directly
supported by, let's say, a single vendor such as Microsoft, that does mean you need to look critically at how those components of the solution are going to be supported and look at the solution as a whole, as opposed to just the software stack. So, yeah, yes and no, I think, is the answer to that one.
The one thing I thought was sort of missing was one of the, you know, so much of support issues are caused by inadequate change control, basically.
Yes.
I would
agree, and the emphasis of this particular session was more on support and a little less on operations, and I would lump change control into more of the operational good practice, but you're right, they are inextricably linked, and yeah, if we had another hour, I think it would have, you know, that's the area we'd definitely go into next, is looking deeply at what are the right ops process and procedures that need to be adopted for Link. And incidentally, it's a piece of work we've just started to really go deep on that so we can help customers understand from a more prescriptive point of view, right, if you follow that prescriptive set of processes, if you can adopt that kind of strategy in your environment, your chances of success, avoiding that drift, configuration drift, are going to be infinitely reduced.
Actually creating this environment versus, and this methodology versus actually supporting the products. You know, it was like the requirements started earlier on when it came to Premier. So I guess my question is, if a customer goes with a partner, a Premier partner,
yes,
what are they missing out on? You know, potentially with Premier and some of the proactive things. I mean, is it truly the Premier that we're talking about today, just supporting Link, and there could be another Premier arrangement that the customer has with Microsoft outside of Link that's
sure.
Helping them with those aspects?
Right. So it's entirely possible that they're engaged with Premier and they have an ops operations consulting engagement going on to drive good process and procedure in that space, particularly generically across their organization. That is entirely possible. We've kind of taken the approach of assume nothing, start with this kind of approach, and if as a partner you're engaged with the customer to deliver support solution, I think it's absolutely incumbent on you guys to go in and bang the drum to say, we can do all of this, but we need to build the structure, the support process, the procedure, and get all that stuff right as well. And that's a partnership between you and the customer. So I think it's something that, if it isn't being driven elsewhere, that's a huge value add to go in and drive that kind of good practice within the customer. So I don't see that as in conflict in any way.
I think sometimes when a customer will say, well, we have Premier, we're engaged with Premier, and understanding how to differentiate, like, you know, based on
yeah.
You are, but you're the things that you're potentially not covering.
No, I think then... I understand, absolutely. And I would definitely say it's worth just getting in touch with the Premier team, talk to the TAM, the customer's TAM, if you can get hold of them, and make sure that you have established that clear water, particularly because then you can maximize your opportunity and avoid any conflict in the account. So everybody knows what everybody else is up to, and that if you're focusing on the Link solution alone, you are going to need to identify, because let's say Active Directory or other components would come into Premier normally, you need to understand what those escalation paths look like. And as you build out that support map, you'll be able to fill in a whole series of boxes on the right-hand side, kind of tier 3, tier 4, which will be Microsoft. But then at least you've got that understanding. Who's responsible for what? How will the escalation paths work? Who would you need to work with ultimately as providing support for the Link solution, which may be internal teams, might be us, might be another vendor. So.
And last question, is yeah. there, if you are a Premier, if you are PSLP,
So the documents that you receive when you are certified as a partner will describe all the escalation paths, processes, response times that you can expect from us. What they won't do is articulate what relationship Microsoft will have with the customer. That obviously is a confidential contract that we have with the end customer around what they've signed up to with us, or we've signed up to with them. So you would, you know, you have a contract with us for support, and we will describe the terms of that contract and what you can expect in terms of service from us. The customer may also have a contract with us for support, but the terms of that contract are confidential between us and the customer. So the route to understand that is through the customer. So make sure that you're clear about how supporting to us will work for dependent components of the solution, and then you can build that into your kind of overall plan that you work with the customer to say, right, we do this bit. If this bit fails, you need to go through Microsoft, grab your TAM, get it escalated, but just so that those dependencies are well understood. But yeah, the relationship with the end customer from the Microsoft perspective, that will be something you'll need to talk to the customer about. That's not information we can share directly. Awesome. Thank you very much indeed for your attention this morning. I hope the hangovers improve. I do very quickly have slides I really need to show you. So the Microsoft Pavilion, it's fantastic, isn't it? Have you twanged the thing yet? Has anybody done that? It looks like fun. Two important things. One is, obviously, there's an attendee party tonight. I'm sure you all know this, and we look forward to seeing you there. Hands-on labs, that's kind of interesting. The one I really want to get to is, bear with me for a second. Right, this one. Evaluations. Please, please, please give us feedback. It's really important. I know there's just a few folks in the room here, but it's really helpful for us to understand whether or not the content is useful, if we're delivering the right material, or what would have been more use. So please, you know, as we go on and do these things again and we start to engage more customers and partners, really, really would appreciate that feedback. Otherwise, sorry for running over by a few minutes. Thank you very much for your time.